KW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CD Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media
ABC
app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. At least six people have died in wildfires across Maui, residents forced to flee homes in the middle of the night. Helicopter pilot Richard Olston getting a bird's eye view of the damage in Lahaina.
We were just speechless with one another as we viewed this horrible destruction of the town.
Tourists being told to stay away and get off the island. An armed Utah man accused of making violent threats against President Biden was shot and killed by FBI agents hours before the president was expected to land in the state. California Senator Dianne Feinstein sent to the hospital yesterday after a fall in her home.
Her staff is calling this hospital visit a precaution. They say the fall was minor. And then they go on to say all of her scans were clear, saying that Senator Feinstein is back home.
ABC's Jay O'Brien. A judge ordering suspected Gilgo Beach serial killer Rex Huerman to turn in a DNA swab. This is ABC News. A cartel member convicted in a double murder in Texas is back in Mexico.
Nicolas Monarez pleaded guilty to the 2007 killing of a pregnant 18-year-old and her 19-year-old boyfriend. He was first sent to a federal prison in West Virginia to serve a 10-year sentence on a separate drug case. He was supposed to be brought back to Texas to serve 15 years for the double murder.
That's where it went completely off rails.
Instead of coming back to Texas, Monarez was deported to Mexico. Dallas County District Attorney John Crusoe.
We're now going back and changing our own process to make certain that that doesn't happen anymore.
The families of Monarez's two victims are furious that he may never do time for their killings.
Amazon's One Medical opening two locations in Connecticut with a third planned for San Francisco, a fourth in Milwaukee. The online services acquired the primary care provider earlier this year. Neptune Beach, Florida is buzzing. That's where the winning $1.5 billion Mega Millions ticket was sold. Andy Field, ABC News.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell, and here's what you need to know. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services wants to train 10,000 people to be state-certified caregivers through a free online course. The program was developed with help from UW Green Bay. The program also gives people a chance to connect with employers who are hiring. Workers who complete the program and get a job can earn up to $500 in hiring and retention bonuses. Green Bay police now have more Narcan to help people with opioid overdoses. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Paul was in Green Bay yesterday. Narcan can quickly restore normal breathing to a person if their breathing is stopped or slowed because of an opioid overdose. The money to pay for it comes from the millions Wisconsin is getting from lawsuits against drug companies. More than 31,000 doses of Narcan have been distributed across Wisconsin. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Do you ever get tired of one-sided conversations? Have you changed the station due to mean-spirited rhetoric? Wouldn't it be refreshing to listen and engage in civilized dialogue about politics and how issues affect our families differently? Welcome to the Rational Revolution. I'm Chris Elfheim.
And I'm Emily Cephos. Together, we'll look at today's issues through a politically purple lens. So join us on Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 on WGBW, WISS, and the Civic Media app.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
We spend $500 on our infants and toddlers on average. If you go to the other countries, you're talking about $11,000 on average in Europe and the other developed countries. It makes a difference. They end up spending less on their K-12 system. They end up spending less on their colleges. They end up spending less on jail.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8.
On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs,
But it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
Tune in Apple, Google, or Amazon Podcasts. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start today off with our thoughts and prayers and hopes and whatever policy we're going to need, whatever help for the folks in Hawaii. I don't know if you've seen the videos coming out of Maui and what they call the Big Island. It looks like the whole place is on fire. It's all like a perfect storm of high winds and fire and all just horrible. Last report I saw, at least 6 people have died in the wildfires that have raged on Maui. And the videos and some of the stories that I've heard of, people are just jumping into the water hoping to be rescued by the Coast Guard or by others because it's literally all on fire. And I know, climate change isn't real. That's what my conservative friends keep telling me, or at least the man-made part of it now isn't. Now, as I understand, all of the 911 communications is down. And this is all, I guess, the result of the high winds from Hurricane Dora and the fires that they'd had. Again, I'm looking at these videos and just total devastation. And you go, you know, at some point, if that doesn't move you to action, I don't know what will. If seeing, you know, this just incredible devastation doesn't move you to go, hey, we need to do something about this. Not quite sure what will. And you know, I look at what this administration has been moving on to address climate change, and it's a step in the right direction. I look at all of the effort to stop that small step, and there are days when I'm hopeless, and I look at there and I feel hopeless. I feel helpless to help those people in that position, but I feel hopeless in that, and that maybe we can't solve big problems anymore because we can't solve small ones. And I'm going to point to the story that I've been kind of fixated on today. There was a story out of Michigan. A 17-year-old kid was working for a a meat processing plant. It's U.S. Guys Processing. And the story says that, you know, he lost his hand in a grinder. Now, you know, 17-year-olds, I don't know, should be, I don't know, around grinders. But what caught my attention wasn't the fact that this 17-year-old kid was working in a place that, you know, was dangerous for him and now is going to lose a hand, or has lost a hand. My thought is the response to it. The response to it is, well, you know, it was a tragedy, you know. And the judge who fined the person who owns the processing plant or the company, fine, they got a fine of, and this is one of those things that I'm stuck with. $1,143. $1,140, that's the fine. And you go, you know, I've said before, if I ever wanted to kill someone, I would just hire them and put them in a dangerous position and well, you know, do whatever I needed to do, because, you know, human life is cheap in the work environment. Now, what I find interesting, I spent a little time looking at social media comments. And now understand, this situation's unique. Understand, this is a unique situation. This is a minor, a 17-year-old, who, as the judge said, in 2 months, it wouldn't have mattered, because then he would have been 18. So it wasn't really a big deal. Still a minor. But that was the reason for this, you know, for the lack of any real penalty. A little slap on the wrist. Fortunately, that guy still has a wrist. And you know, nothing further. And I spent time in the comments, and I tell you not to, because there's nothing positive in the comments. But what was amazing to me is the number of people who were commenting, well, you know, he's going to sue that employer, and, you know, he's going to get millions of dollars. It's one of these moments where, as Americans, we're so, steal a Ronald Reagan line, there's so much that we know that isn't so. This is one of those things. This kid was employed, so he's going to be covered under workers' comp. Now, someone said the caveat here potentially is that, you know, he was a minor. There was a fine, so maybe possibly going to get something down the road more than workers' comp. I doubt it, to be honest, because again, the mentality is, well, he was only a couple of months away. He's a high school dropout, and oh, by the way, we told him not to do it. So I'm reading through all these comments, and the comments are all in the same kind of line. Well, he's going to sue, and he'll get pain and suffering, and he'll get all this stuff. And as anyone knows, workers' comp, you don't get pain and suffering. I actually looked up Michigan's workers' compensation law, which was passed, you know, or last amended, I guess. Or no, it was actually passed in 1969. The Workers' Disability Compensation Act of 1969, Act 317, by the way. And what it says is, you know, you're going to get 80% of your pay. And if you lose a hand, 215 weeks. That's what you're going to get. A little over 4 years. Because what happens in a lot of states, these workers' compensation laws, they lay all this stuff out meticulously. It's like an insurance policy, because it is. And this idea that you're going to be able to then sue doesn't happen, because the great compromise that was made when they allowed workers' compensation to be passed, and employers weren't upset by it, because now they're no longer really liable. It's just an insurance thing. You get hurt, somebody will pay. Some of my premiums may go up a little bit, but it's not my problem. And Republicans throughout the years have been doing their foolhardy best to minimize the benefits and the accountability for corporate America. So, like in my state of Pennsylvania, 1996, they did a major overhaul of workers' compensation, where if you get hurt in this state, pretty much the maximum you're going to get is, I think it's 85% of your pay for 500 weeks. And that's it. After that, you're SOL, you're on your own. Good luck, buddy. Find another gig or go on disability, which is all government's always the backstop for corporate bad ideas. And I spent time reading these comments just amazed that people think this way. And I shouldn't be, because most working people don't, fortunately, don't have to deal with these systems until something really bad happens. And we as Americans don't think we talk enough about this kind of stuff. Whereas me as a union guy, this stuff is front and center. This stuff is important. Policy is important. And which is why I constantly say Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at how they go after and try and gut workers' comp. Look at how they go after unemployment and try and gut that. Look at the fact that they're against raising the minimum wage. Go and look at the policies that they stand for, or obviously don't. And this is one of those things that caught me. And I started just, my mind was just flowing around this idea, which is why, you know, I go, this is why you see so many third-party logistics companies and so many temp agencies popping up. Because this is a good way to shield the main corporation from, well, any of these pesky things. Because you can start up a temp agency, hire a bunch of people to come in, and then, you know, the main company doesn't have to employ them. The temp agency does. So if they get hurt on the employer's property, it's the temp agency's fault. And when the premiums get too high, they just close up the temp agency and move right along to the next one. Who gets screwed in all this? The workers. And this, again, is one of these moments where my mind just, you know, kept going back to, how is it that there's so much that we know that isn't so? You think of that great compromise. I think the first workers' comp law was in, I believe, Wisconsin, 1912. Pennsylvania passed its workers' comp law in 1915. And still refers to the employer-employee relationship as master and servant, which tells you where you working people would fare in this. But when that compromise happened, and I'm no lawyer, but this is what happened, workers gave up their ability to sue in court. They gave up their ability to hold liable the corporations. In return for giving up their constitutional right to sue, they were given medical care and some wage benefits. And that seemed like a good compromise at the time. Because what was happening back then, before workers' comp, and you had the ability to sue, because this is how this suit would work out in a place that didn't have this compromise. This kid, this 17-year-old, would go to sue, and the employer would come forth and say, look, he was a high school dropout. Yeah, we were trying to help the kid out. We brought him in to sweep up and do some stuff. We told him repeatedly, don't put your hand inside the grinder. Told you not to do it. They would say, it's his fault. He deserved what he got. And a jury back then would say, okay. Now, if you paid the jury a little bit, I'm sure that helped too. And that, I'm sure, happened quite often. But the system, again, rigged against the average everyday working person. This reminds me of that exact scenario. And I'm looking at this going, this poor kid. But everyone believes he's going to be taken care of. And that's kind of the world that we're kind of in this moment. And when we come back, I gotta talk about this video. Because it's amazing. I just talked about this last night. My generation and kids, this video caught my attention, and I think it will catch yours as well. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday on the program, we talked about just this. What happened to the American dream? You know, what happened to work hard, play by the rules, get ahead? You know, when I grew up, you know, I struggled, but because I was able to get a good union job and was willing to work 70 hours a week and do all of those things, I did okay. And a lot of parents around my age, a lot of people that I've talked to and a lot of stories I've seen have said, you know, it's not the same as it was when I was a kid. It's not the same same environment. So today I see this video of this Jessica McCabe, who went on Twitter and, well, she had this to say.
I am so tired of feeling helpless as a parent. Yes, my kids are grown adults. My oldest is 28, my youngest is 25. And I thought by teaching them what I learned, which is you work hard, you get a good job, you're going to get the things in life that you need, right? Worked for me. Why wouldn't it work for them? Because it doesn't. Because the world has changed, all right? And now I feel like I see them struggling. And before my generation comes at me, yes, I understand struggling is a part of life. We all struggled. But there's a difference between struggling and drowning, all right? So we struggled and it was tough. But you know what? We made it. We knew there was a light at the end of the tunnel with our struggle. It seems like kids today, no matter how much they struggle, they just get further and further down the water into the drowning point, all right? When I was their age, I was making less than $10 an hour, and I could afford to live on my own. Now you have to be making six-figure salary to get a decent, tiny little place to live. So what the f*** is going on, and how do we help them as parents? I told my son, all you have to do is work hard, go to college, or join the military like I did. He went to college, got his degree, got a full-time job. He moved back in with me right when he graduated from college because he said, hey, Mom, as soon as I get a job, which was within 2 weeks of him getting out of college, maybe take me 2 months and I'll save up enough money for me to move out. Okay, cool. It's been 10 months. He has saved almost every dime and still can't afford to live. Why are one-bedroom studio apartments almost $2,000 a month? Why? Like, I just don't get it. So I don't even think that there's even classes anymore. There used to be upper class, middle class, lower class. It's literally turning into the ultra wealthy and then everybody else is just poor.
No, this is one of these things where, you know, you've got this woman from Alabama who is looking at her children and going, you know, they're struggling and their struggle is not getting any easier. And I talked about this yesterday, you know, this idea that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you got ahead, you knew you took the crappy job, you'd be able to move up, you'd be able to do better, all of this stuff. And as I was listening to her, because when we did our Working Class Heroes tour last year, we went into virtually every community and heard this over and over again. I've been talking about this for a couple of years now. I'd like to know what bubble this woman lives in. I'd love to know what bubble she's been surrounded by all these years, because none of this is new. And what's interesting to me is, and I'm going to go on a limb here and go, I'm betting she voted for Republicans all these years who it's their policies. Now, here's the reality. The party that's able to address her concerns is the party that's going to gain her loyalty. And as I've said, the fact of the matter is I guarantee it. She votes for Republicans. And they are the root of all of these problems. Bad policy brought us here.
conservative supply-side voodoo Reaganomics brought us here. Neoliberalism brought us here. And the idea that we don't need unions anymore, the idea that we don't need collective bargaining or solidarity or any, we don't need that. Our corporate masters will somehow take care of us. Well, it's breaking down. When you look at there was a study done a couple of years ago by the Economic Policy Institute that said that CEO pay from 1978 until, I guess it was 18 or 19 when it came out, had risen by 940%. But worker pay, just 12%. And again, we've talked about, you know, from the end of World War II to the middle 70s, how, you know, worker pay and productivity walked hand in hand. As productivity went up, wages went up. A meritocracy. But you had unions there to demand, which is why, as I talked about yesterday, Sean Fain, the UAW president, saying, look, we want 40% raises for our employees over the next 4 years. And where did he pull that number out? Well, he pulled it out of the CEOs and the executives at the automakers. That's what they got, a 40% increase over the last 4 years. He didn't just make it up. He said, look, if it's good enough for you, it should be good enough for us. And I look at that 940% number and go, you know, if it's good enough for corporate America, if it's good enough for the executives in the suits in the boardroom, it's good enough for the people who sweep the floors and do the work and sadly potentially lose a hand while doing it. It's infuriating to me that we're in this space. But I look at her and I say, here's the thing. If you can reach her, if you can share your policies, and you can make her see that you're making lives better, you're going to gain her loyalty and millions of other people. Because maybe now, for the first time, they're finally waking up to the reality that it's not all roses. That dream that they were sold is turned into more of a nightmare. Because we've got a tax code that's rigged, we've got a labor law that's rigged, we've got a system that's completely rigged for the wealthy in this country. You know, CEO pay, we talked about this the other day, 270-1 in 2020, or 2022. In 1965, it was 15-1. You know what else we had in 1965? 35% union density. Let's go to the phones. Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So what I wanted to say was, with regards to a couple of things. Number one, you got the kid working in there, should never have been in there. Now he's going to lose a hand. And guess what? Who is going to have to handle taking care of things? His family.
Yeah.
They're going to have to pay, no doubt, for his medical.
No, he'll get medical through workers' comp. They'll cover that. But he'll get nothing.
Right.
215
well,
weeks of pay, and he's screwed for the rest of it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying, where I'm going with this. There's just a basic amount, and then, you know, so they're going to end up having to have a GoFundMe or something. The second thing is, like the woman that was, you know, I don't know, giving her opinion, I guess is what I want to say. Yeah, once upon a time, there was the American dream. But like you said, the system's rigged. But the system is rigged overall. It's not just rigged for the wealthy. It's rigged so nobody can rise any higher anymore. That's, you know, unless you come up with something new and improved and out of this world and make a gazillion dollars on it, selling it for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, and I'm going to go with Republicans in particular because I know a number of Republicans, and they all have this mindset. They seem to believe that they're going to end up being wealthy, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, well, we shouldn't have to raise the taxes on the wealthy because I'm going to be wealthy.
I'm going to be there someday.
I don't want to pay all that money.
No, I love that Steinbeck's embarrassed millionaire. Yeah, I'm there. I hear it. I know people like that, Alice. Appreciate the thoughts.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, you get what you vote for. And if you're buying into this alternate reality, this conspiracy nonsense that, you know, everybody's lazy and nobody wants to get ahead. And that's why I'm going to vote Republican, because guns, God, and Jesus, you know. Well, then don't complain when it comes back and bites you, because eventually it gets us all. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I mean, the reality is I feel her. I feel her pain. I do. And what I'm saying is she can be reached. And millions of voters like her can be reached. You have to get that policy out there. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day 53 construction tradesmen were killed in a fire at the Titan II ICBM launch complex near Searcy, Arkansas. It is considered one of the worst industrial accidents at a U.S. nuclear weapons facility. The complex was one of four sites containing Titan II missiles. Each missile weighed 340,000 pounds, measuring 103 feet in length and 10 feet in diameter. President Johnson had just committed more troops to the Vietnam War. The Air Force had hoped to strengthen the silo against a possible Soviet attack. They had contracted with Peter Kiewit and Son of Colorado to bring in electricians, carpenters, millwrights, painters, and pipe fitters for a number of tasks. Crews worked to shore up the silo, improve the blast doors, adjust hydraulics, and install emergency lighting. 52 of the 55 workers on all 9 levels of the silo were almost immediately asphyxiated when it suddenly filled with smoke and heat. The Air Force determined a welder on level 2 had accidentally pierced a high-pressure hydraulic line, igniting the fire. Investigators also concluded that the silo lacked adequate ventilation, alternative exits, and independent power sources. The contractor was held responsible for numerous safety violations, contributing to unsafe work conditions. The welder was found drowned in hydraulic fluid. 2 survivors suffered burns and smoke inhalation. They contested the Air Force's findings. One worker insisted no one had been welding on level 2. The other survivor stated he saw flames burst from the diesel engine just before the power went out. Both men insisted the fire started from below. By 1981, 2 more deadly accidents involving Titan II missiles would prompt President Reagan to order their deactivation. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
How about a little bit of good news for a change? Specifically, good news about news. The demise of local newspapers has been a very depressing story in the last few years, with several thousand of them gobbled up by Wall Street profiteers. Those money powers loot the publication's assets, then callously shut down each community's paper or reduces them to empty news shelves. So, that's that. Local print journalism is passé, right? Wrong! High-spirited, community-minded subscribers in places like Glen Rose, Texas, Hamburg, Iowa, Portland, Maine, and International Falls, Minnesota, are humming an upbeat tune of regeneration that could be titled, Not Dead Yet. In Maine, for example, 5 of the state's 6 daily papers and 17 weeklies were sinking under the ownership of an investment group. But all were recently bought by the National Trust for Local News, a nonprofit started 2 years ago. The trust is turning each publication over to local nonprofit owners and helping them find ways to become sustainable. Another new effort called Cherry Road Media has bought 77 rural papers in 17 states, most from the predatory Gannett conglomerate that wanted to dump them. Cherry Road's business plan is simple, old-time genius. Return editorial decision-making to local people and journalists who know the town. Be an active presence and participant in community affairs. Make the locals responsible for sustaining their town's paper and, most important, reinvest profits in real local journalism that advances democracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, in both of these new initiatives, the foremost mission is to serve the common good of the communities, not to pad the wealth of a few distant financiers. To learn more about these models and how you might implement something similar in your town, contact Institute for Rural Journalism, ruraljournalism.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday we talked about Vice President Kamala Harris in Philadelphia to announce the policy change of, you know, restoring the power of prevailing wage. And as you know, I've been a big supporter of prevailing wage and project labor agreements for a very long time. But the vice president was at the Finishing Trades Institute in Philadelphia, where she gave her remarks. And look, it's about making jobs better. It's about making those jobs pay better. It's about addressing, you know, that woman we talked about a minute ago, making sure that her kids have the ability to move out of the house and start their own lives. And here to share some thoughts on the event in Philadelphia, I've asked Jim Williams Jr. to come talk with us. Jim is the general president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, IUPAT.org, the website. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
So the vice president was in Philly. I kind of screwed up your union's name.
Yeah, you got it right when you said IUPAT.org. I jokingly say that's okay if that's the only thing she screws up. I think we're going to be all right.
And that's really the message that came out of that. I mean, she hit it out of the park, I thought, talking about how we're going to raise wages, ensure that the work that's being done with our tax dollars is being used to generate economic activity in communities. It's doesn't sound like a downside here to me.
No, this truly is like, you know, you're hearing the administration try to label Bidenomics as the new economic, you know, positioning of the government. And, you know, this is like one of those very, very detailed, wonky kind of things that truly speak to what that means about building the economy from the middle class out versus, you know, from the Reaganomics era of trickle-down economics. And this is like one of those examples that is right on display of restoring, you know, Davis-Bacon prevailing wage back to what the original intent of the law was when it was passed as a New Deal era piece of legislation to help support public works projects to get us out of the depression.
Right.
You know, this is Bidenomics is a restoration and a turning around of all of those years of Reagan trickle down economics. And this is one of those examples.
No, I keep saying this administration is ending the era of supply side voodoo Reaganomics and neoliberalism. They're just not touting it and saying it the right way and not getting it out there. But this prevailing wage, Davis-Bacon, this is a part of this. But understand, the vast majority of people have no idea what we're talking about when we talk about prevailing wage laws. So if you could, you know, because this is your world, explain to folks, you know, what the original intent of the prevailing wage law was and how it worked through the 50s, 60s, and really, you know, the 83 seems to be the year they're pointing to when things started to go south. So if you could give me a little bit of that history, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. And I'll try to do so in a very quick manner to lay out exactly where the inflection points were. But if you remember in the Depression, we had the most public works projects ever. The government was wanting to put people back to work in good paying jobs, very similar to where we stand today. And in order to do so, to make sure and ensure that they were good paying jobs, they came up with prevailing wage laws through the Davis-Bacon Act, that when a survey would be done, they would survey the construction workers in a geographical area, and it's usually done by counties in the United States. And if a wage prevailed at over 50%, that would be what the federal government would pay the contractors that did the work on the projects. Well, and it lasted that way all the way until 1983. And it was, you know, it was honestly one of the attacks that the ABC and other, you know, anti-union forces lined up against in the 1970s to try to weaken union strength. And they were successful under Reaganomics. And under the change in the provisions in 1983, they changed the formula to say that if you didn't prevail over 50%, well, sorry, let me make a correction. In the 1930s, the number was 30%. In 1983, they jumped it up to 50%. And on top of it said, we'll just take an average wage if nobody has over 50%. So that average wage wouldn't take into effect collective bargaining increases. You've seen them last sometimes for 15 years without increases, with no surveys being done. The change that the administration announced yesterday is to go back to the 30% and modernize and update the survey system and put more enforcement against employers that violate not paying the prevailing wage laws. And look, the interesting part about this is the ABC and other anti-union groups came out against it day one and said this is a handout to big labor. The truth is, any worker, regardless of whether they're union or non-union, are going to see their wages go up when these surveys get released and the wages are increased. It doesn't matter if you're union or non-union. If you're working in the construction industry on federally funded projects, you're going to see your wages go up.
Yeah,
well, so it shows you what they really think of workers.
Well, in places where, as you pointed out a second ago, employers aren't cheating them. And I've known a lot of non-union construction workers who their contractors have cheated them on the prevailing wage rates, where they're doing jobs that should be paid at a higher rate and they're being classified as something different. So to hear that there's going to be more enforcement, I think is really good to hear, because, you know, we need that. But more importantly, we need the money in the communities, because what we know and what research has shown us, and you know this better than anyone, when that construction worker, when that painter is making a good wage, they're spending that money on Main Street. They're spending that money in their community, and it's reverberating through. So it's a win-win all across the board.
Of course it is. And when you look at the record amount of government spending that's being pumped into the construction industry tied to Davis-Bacon and prevailing wages, this is truly going to be a monumental period, the next 10 years, of having workers making family-sustaining wages and building communities out, because prevailing wages and Davis-Bacon were extended into things that they've never been extended before under the passage of the CHIPS and Science Act. Anybody that gets federal spending through the CHIPS and Science Act is going to have to pay Davis-Bacon wages on the construction of their projects. Same thing with the IRA. It's not just the infrastructure bills that were passed. The interesting part about modernizing the Davis-Bacon system and going back to the old formula is that it applies to more work now than ever before.
No, that's a good thing. Now, I gotta ask you this, because I got an email from a listener in Chicago who said, it's all fine, well, and good. The vice president had her moment in the sun. It's not going to help me a bit in Chicago because, you know, as this person said, as a unionized construction worker, he's not going to see any increase. He believed that it's all going to help red states. We're going to all help southern states do better. It's all going to be the red states again who benefit from progressive policies, even though they hate Democrats and hate progressive politicians. What do you say to that?
Yeah, listen, I say, you know, first off, where the unions have prevailed over the years, yes, we've been able to maintain high Davis-Bacon prevailing wages, and that's good. But in order to lift our industry, we have to make sure that workers that are working in the non-union sector have access to high wages as well, and that there's enforcement of that. Look, it's a good policy for the American working class, period. And it always was. And it's a good organizing tool for us as unions to be able to talk to workers and say, look, the unions have helped set the rates here. And that's the reason why you're making more money on your check. It's the reason why collective bargaining matters. And it's a better time to have those conversations now rather than any other time. Now, the other thing I would say is the policies of this government, Rick, will create more Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage jobs. So it will help that worker in Chicago. It helps that worker in Philadelphia. Yeah, this one particular piece, if in that area your wages prevailed, that's one thing. But you got to look at the overall package of what this government is doing. Pumping money into the construction industry like never before, it's going to create more opportunities for that member in Chicago.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Jim Williams, Jr., president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, IUPAT.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do there. Now, again, I come back to this, you know, this Bidenomics, frame that they're throwing out there, that they are reshoring manufacturing. We are doing some infrastructure, even though this American Society of Civil Engineers says we need like $4.8 trillion. This is a good step and a start in the right direction. And then now with this to raise wages up, do you think we're going to start seeing more people heading into the trades? I know you guys are ramping up your apprenticeship programs and all this. Do you expect a wave of people coming into these? Because these are really good jobs.
Yeah, we really do, Rick. We see the next 5 years and really the next 10 years as pivotal for the growth of our organizations. And it's long overdue. I mean, we have been stagnant. You know, I'm not going to lie. It's not like we've seen our unions grow over the course of the last 40, 50 years. And this opportunity that's in front of us is enormous. We've already witnessed, and listen, some of these projects are literally just getting out of the ground. There's an enormous electric battery plant being prepared to be built in Columbus, Ohio. Same thing with the semiconductor plants in New York and Tennessee. We already seen in the last 2 months the highest rate of membership growth in our union in the last 15 years, just in the last 2 months. And if that's any indicator of what the future is going to hold for us, we have a really bright future ahead of us. And it gives us an opportunity to bring people into our unions that never had opportunities in the past. And we are focused on that, laser focused on that, because our time is really right in front of us.
Yeah. No, look, we have, building trades people on the program who tell that story, how, you know, there was a guy from the IBW we had on a while ago, you know, who got out of jail and had no path and ended up going through an apprenticeship program. He now makes $100,000 a year, owns a home, and is living the dream. These are good jobs. They're jobs you're going to have to work at, but they pay a good wage, and it's a good way to be moving. My problem is we're coming up on election time, and all this can go away.
Right.
Because I don't want to be overly partisan with you, but you know, I say again, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And right now, the people who are in the House are trying everything they can do to gut any investment that we're doing. So elections have consequences.
No doubt. This election coming up is, yeah, you know, we say it every time, but it's a pivotal election. It's a decision for working people. Do they want to go backwards into the policies, the failed policies of all the previous administrations? And I would even throw Democrats into the mix. Look, I say this everywhere I go. I used to have to hold my nose and vote for Democrats because the Republicans were the worst option on the ballot. Now, it's not the case. With the policies that have been put in place, with the way the party has been moving towards working people, look, it's not perfect. We have a long way to go. But it's a start to something. And if we end it in just 4 short years, we're going to have a long crawl back. So look, I agree with you. I mean, right now, the way that party is, it's gotten worse and worse every day. That we have to support those that support us. We have to continue to hold them accountable. We have to continue to try to push them on real things like labor law reform, which we are still far away from getting, but we can't turn a blind eye to the fact that this administration has been the most pro-union administration in our lifetimes.
I absolutely agree. And here's the weird little factoid, the little trivia game piece. Davis Bacon, both Republicans.
Yeah. Rick, there was a time in my career where there was a solid block of 60 to 70 Republican congressmen, Republican members of Congress that strongly called themselves Davis Bacon Republicans. That number ain't 60 to 70 anymore. And you know where they came from? They came from blue states. And there's few and far between anymore. The reality is, look, that party has lost its soul. That party is so far anti-democratic right now that we have no other choice than to mobilize and continue to push the Democratic Party closer and closer to labor's values.
And that's what we talk about all the time here on the program. But Jim, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work, and I hope you'll come back and share some more with us down the road.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Again, you check out their website, iupat.org. Jim Williams Jr., the general president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Want to hear your thoughts right back after this. Stick around. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in strike. The women made wigs for export. The company had been one of the leading exporters in the nation. But then the managers began to move the profits from the wig company to a shipping company under the same ownership, as well as to a film production company. This drained the profits from the wig factory and left it in massive debt. The owners shut down the company without warning, firing all of the employees. These women did not only lose their jobs. Water and electricity were turned off at the factory dormitories where the workers lived. A union represented the young women. The union planned a strike at the building, but the police were called in to break it up. The workers decided to move their protest to the local headquarters of the New Democratic Party. The party was in opposition to the leader of Seoul, President Park Chung-hee. The fired women were welcomed at the New Democratic Party headquarters. There, they decided to stage a sit-in to bring attention to their situation. The workers' sit-in only lasted 3 days. Then 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently. One woman, 21-year-old Kim Young-suk, died in the raid. She fell from the roof of the building in a clash with the police. 4 of the union leaders were sent to prison. More than 200 of the workers were expelled out of the city of Seoul and sent back home to rural areas. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's interesting he brought up the fact that there used to be pro-labor Republicans. And now, as I say, you know, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at what they do. Every red state has gone after gutting prevailing wage laws. Everyone has gone after gutting the ability to collectively bargain. And they've done all of the whole no rights at work agenda. You know, attacking workers' comp, attacking unemployment, all of that safety net that our grandparents' generation fought, bled, and died for. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you, buddy?
Fine, thank you. And I think that this is a great opportunity to sort of help people to link a couple of different variables, things that are happening and have happened in our society. Because there was a time when a lot of the Rust Belt was firmly in the camp of Democrats come election time. Now, let's then remember that, and then also let's keep in mind, with the decline of labor and unions in those regions, what have we seen? Well, we've seen a shift in terms of how those states vote, and they are no longer firmly in the Democratic camp, as recent elections have demonstrated. And I contend to you the following, that a lot of those guys used to vote that way because the Democratic Party was perceived as the party of labor. They made sure the safe working conditions, you had benefits, you know, that you had a pension, and you voted Democrat as a result. If the working class white guy wasn't out there voting Democrat because he was some champion of civil rights or women's rights or the gay community or anything else, I mean, you know, we could try and imagine that they were, and perhaps they were, some of them that were, but by and large, they were not. A lot of them were socially conservative. It's just that on the issues of labor, that's what bought them out to vote for Democrats. But yep. As union power has eroded in those areas, well, guess what? Those people have nothing to come to the Democratic Party for any longer, at least not in their minds. I think that they're misguided. I think that if they want to improve the quality of their life, they should vote Democrat. But the Republican Party has succeeded in pulling them away because they don't see the Democratic Party as doing anything for them anymore because, again, union membership has declined dramatically. If you eliminate or rather just extract out the public sector unions in this country, the people who belong to unions that represent private industry, that's a small number compared to what it was in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, it's 6.7% right now.
So Yeah, exactly. So these are the way that things are linked in our society. You know, so we've got to convince people that, you know, we've been here before. This whole race to the bottom thing, you know, hey, come to our state. You know, you can pay people next to nothing, relocate your corporate headquarters here, and you don't have to be in New York or Illinois or California. Come to Florida and Texas. Yeah, sure, you can come to Florida and Texas, and it'll take three of you working out in one household in order to pay the bills. Now, yes, you can buy a home for less, and the cost of living is slightly less, except that not really, because if you take into consideration the fact that, you know, Texas doesn't have a state income tax, that means you're paying the full freight for the local school system, and you're not getting anything else compared to New York or California or Illinois in terms of social programs and things that you'll need in case the bottom should fall out, as it does with so many of us in our lives at some point. So, yeah, I mean, we need to convince them that we are on their side, and that they need to be incentivized to vote. Again, Democrats need to get people to vote for them and not always be pulled back into this some of these social issues. You know, we can be on the side of the right people when it comes to transgender and sexual orientation and women and race. Yeah, all of those things matter. But the thing that matters most to us is we need to get people on our side when it comes to labor and work and who represents us, who represents the people in that regard, because it certainly isn't the Republican Party.
No, you're spot on. In fact, you know, the reality is we saw that time and time again as we did our tour last year. We went into the communities in Iowa and Wisconsin that, you know, used to be somewhere. You know, Toledo used to be the glass capital of the world. We went into those places and people still remember that, you know, that we used to do this and the jobs that were created and the lifestyle that it was afforded. And that's all gone. I mean, you know, the whole book, What's the Matter with Kansas, is the premise that you just laid out.
Yeah, and you were just discussing about the trades and so forth. I mean, there are things which, for the foreseeable future, aren't going anywhere. There are things that you can outsource to China or India or Mexico. But if it's 90 degrees out and I'm here in Chicago and my AC goes out, they're not flying in somebody from China to fix it. An American has got to come out and fix it. So, you know, there are still opportunities here, but we also need to be more inclusive. We need to create a bigger tent and reimagine union membership and the protections that we used to extend to factory workers to extend it to service workers and other people, because that's the new economy. And the people that used to work in factories are now working in service jobs. And we need to start that process of unionizing those people that were once excluded, because you weren't covered if you worked at the fast food joint. Unlike my father, who used to work at U.S. Steel in the 1970s and 80s until they laid him off. Well, we need to include other people again, create a bigger tent.
100% agree. But here's the thing: those factory jobs weren't good jobs until they were union jobs.
Absolutely, absolutely. The people need to understand: in 1969, a factory worker in America working in a union shop made about the equivalent of $140,000 in today's money. So you wonder how that person was able to afford a home, put a couple of cars in the driveway, go on vacation, you know, put money away for retirement. That's how. That's how. But where do you hear of that kind of salary today for somebody working in that kind of job?
No, absolutely. And you know, the woman that I played the video of from Alabama, who's wondering why her kids can't make it, you know, this is what she needs to hear. Because, you know, I talk about the trucking industry when I started. You know, back in the 80s, you know, a truck driver was making in today's dollars over 100 grand a year. Now it's about 45 grand a year. Where'd that money go? Well, we know where it went. It went to our 1%. And that's the sad reality of where we are. And as Harry Truman said, if you want to live like a Republican, vote for a Democrat.
Absolutely. Great quote. Great
Thanks,
quote.
Steve.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. No, that's the reality of the world that we're in. And Steve laid it out so perfectly. Because, you know, that whole reward for work thing, there's got to be a policy behind it. There's no invisible hand doling out justice. There's no invisible hand ensuring that you're paid a reasonable wage. There's not. There's the benevolence of a corporate dictator. The only thing that stands in the way of that benevolence, that dictator, is a union demanding. And this is why I go back to Sean Fain at the UAW right now. Finally, someone is going, hey,
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.